This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we begin with a conversation about capitalism's relationship with democracy and fascism in the U.S. today.
Our guest is Professor Richard Wolff, who the New York Times has said is probably America's most able Marxist economist.
Then, as our nation continues to be divided over how the state of Israel is conducting its war in Palestine, we examine the history and meaning of Zionism.
Our guest is Amaya Gelman, who will help us understand the difference between criticism of Israel and criticism of Zionism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The great German playwright and political figure Bertolt Brecht observed that to understand fascism, you have to understand capitalism from whence it springs. Today, it is also helpful to us to understand that the rise of fascism in Germany 100 years ago has parallels that we can now see with respect to the rise of fascism here in the United States. Prior to World War I, which began in 1914, the German working class and middle class were relatively prosperous. The German unions were strong and influential. Prior to World War I, Germany also had the largest and strongest socialist party in the world, and it was the second largest political party in the German parliament. The German economy was booming, and German culture was the jewel of Europe. This all came to a crashing end in 1917, when Germany was defeated in what was an inter-imperial war against the United States, France, Great Britain, and Russia. The consequences of that defeat brought us fascism and World War II 20 years later. In the 1920s, inflation wiped out the savings of the German people, and when the Depression hit in 1929, the German working class was desperate. The ground was fertile for the rise of Adolf Hitler, a ruthless, cunning, and violent demagogue. Here in the United States, our economy boomed for 100 years, from the end of the Civil War until the 1970s. But since then, American workers have not made any progress. Their wages, in fact, in real terms, have not risen in 50 years. Neoliberalism, which is just another word for aggressive capitalism, has wiped out 30 million industrial jobs in the United States starting in the 1980s. Women were driven back into the workforce. People had to work two jobs just to keep up. In Germany, it was the Jews who were blamed. Here in the United States, it is immigrants and people of color who are scapegoated. The demagogue Trump, like Hitler before him, is a captivating speaker and a very effective cult leader who is now poised to take the power of the government and turn it against we the people. So we will talk today with our returning guest economist, Richard Wolff. Professor Wolff from the University of Massachusetts and the author of the forthcoming book, Understanding Capitalism. According to the New York Times, Richard Wolff is, and I quote, probably America's most prominent Marxist economist. Well, Richard Wolff, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
All right, sir. Now, Richard, you know, you've so well much of your life, your intellectual life, certainly studying, teaching, writing about capitalism. And in fact, you have a new book coming out titled Understanding Capitalism. So let's talk about capitalism's relationship to democracy and relationship to fascism here in the U.S. and, of course, 100 years ago in Germany.
My pleasure. I'd be glad to. It's, you know, it's one of those urgent topics that almost escapes attention because it either overwhelms people or they think it's ancient history, and it isn't. It's very applicable to the immediate crises that we face.
So explain that to us. Why do you believe that is the case?
Well, capitalism is a system that has built into it at least two fundamental qualities that produce one crisis after another. And the first of those qualities is inequality. In other words, capitalism is a system that produces extreme wealth at one end, you know, Elon Musk's and people like that, and then a vast army of people who are barely make ends meet, which is, you know, the bottom two-thirds of the American people, and the same is true in most other capitalist countries. When you produce inequality like that, and you reproduce it generation by generation, you also produce enormous social tension. On the part of the mass of people, you produce bitterness, anger, resentment, envy, all of those things that go into being on the short end of the stick and seeing your parents in that position and your children in that position. On the other hand, among the few who are rich, you get this kind of anxiety that they understand very well that they are the rich surrounded by a sea of people who are bitter about it. And so they turn to the police and the military, desperate to protect what they have against all. In other words, built into this system is a level of conflict and tension that periodically explodes. And the forms of explosion go everywhere from the individual act of violence against a family member, against a neighbor, against a coworker, when the pressures of being in debt and the pressures of being unable to afford to put food on the table blow up a person's tolerability. We are all human. We can only take so much. Then there are revolutions. Then there are workers who go on strike. But on the other side of the coin, then there are the people who want a government that will protect them, that will have the streets full of police and military, monitoring everything we do, controlling everything we do, punishing the slightest infraction. And when that process goes far enough, you call it fascism. It takes that particular form in which the government is brought in as a kind of day-by-day partner to the business community, the employer class, to impose and enforce the capitalist system because the mass of people either don't want it, don't stand it, can't tolerate it, or are beginning to rumble that they want change. And capitalism keeps producing it. It produced it in Europe in the last century multiple times. We had it in the 1930s so badly in the names of Mussolini and Hitler and others, that we had a world war, killed, you know, 40, 50 million people coming out of the challenge of fascism to try to become the next phase of human history. So it's always lurking, and it always looks at beginnings of tension as a chance to justify its argument that you have to do that to save the people at the top. You know, in Germany, this was all organized around demonizing Jews and certain other groups of minorities. Nowadays, it's organized around demonizing immigrants and other minorities. It always finds some scapegoats because it doesn't want to answer the question, why is our society torn apart, by answering, it's our capitalist system, because that's a taboo. And so you look for an alternative explanation, and then there are the usual scapegoats, and that's what fascism distinguishes itself about. It goes after those scapegoats and literally kills them.
Rick, what did the economic policies of neoliberalism do to the American working class?
Well, the major thing, there are several. Economic liberalism, for lack of a better term, something that became dominant again in the 1970s. It had been dominant earlier, by the way. That's why it's called neoliberalism, because it's the newer version, but it's an old business. This is the idea that the economy will work best if you leave it in the hands of the employer class. The U.S. Census today says 3% of the American people are employers. The rest of us are employees. So in other words, if you take liberalism seriously, then you put into the driver's seat of society the 3% of people who employ the rest of us. And that idea leads you then to have the very inequalities I just mentioned. And you also have, very serious, a kind of built-in instability. Every 4 to 7 years, capitalist economic systems everywhere in the world crash. Sometimes the economic downturn, and by the way, it's called a recession or a depression or a crisis or a correction. I mean, they're endless terms because this is always with us in capitalism. Every 4 to 7 years, sometimes it only lasts a few months. Sometimes it lasts 10 years. Sometimes it only throws 1 million people out of work. Sometimes it throws 50 million people out of work. In other words, capitalism is a system that not only produces and reproduces huge inequality, it's also unstable. And unstable on a scale and on a level that makes people really bitter and angry. And what you saw over the last 30 to 40 years, the neoliberalism, that corporations got the control here in America. They pushed back on what the New Deal had achieved. They undid the New Deal in the 40 years afterwards. And then they went to town and they did three crucial things. Number one, they moved production out of the United States to other parts of the world where labor was cheaper, above all Asia and above all China. Number two, they replaced expensive workers with automation, the computer, the robot, and now artificial intelligence. These two things destroyed tens of millions of jobs and dumped the people who lost those jobs into very bad situations for themselves, for the families that depended on them, for the communities that depended on those families. And you basically split the United States into the minority that did well by moving production to Europe, or to Asia, excuse me, and the majority that are looking around trying to figure out what happened. That's why Mr. Trump is successful with a slogan like MAGA, because it's a fancified notion of a good old days that are now gone. The good old days weren't that good, and they didn't disappear by some magic. That was a decision of capitalists in America to go to where the profit was highest, which is what they always do, and now it meant leaving the United States, and the working class is stuck with the result. It's very bitter, and so the ruling class has to turn to fascistic ways of keeping control. That's what the Trump administration and the Trump campaign is all about. That's what the 2025 plan is all about. These are the steps taken when the capitalist system once again finds the inequality and the instability bringing to the edge of the sustainability of their system, and then they turn to force, to violence, in a word, to fascism.
Richard, following along on what you were just talking about, and you mentioned Trump, he, of course, has the political and financial support of, well, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, both billionaires 100 times over, and a lot of folks like him. And for that matter, Harris has the support of Wall Street, too. Talk to us again about why they enjoy that kind of support and what that really means.
I'll be diplomatic. The employer class of our country understood that they don't want to be altogether identified with one party or the other party. The reason is that then the working class might figure out that the way to defeat the employer class, to make their wages better, to make their job security stronger, and so on, was to line up behind the other party. The whole origin of socialist political parties in Europe and here in the United States was premised on the notion that since the vast majority of people are in the working class, socialism should appeal to them. It's what's for them rather than for the capitalists, and so that they would organize a political party. The risk, of course, was that the mass of workers would understand it that way too, and would vote for the Socialist Party, which in many parts of the world, including here in the United States, large numbers of workers did. If you go back to the American Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, socialist parties in the 1930s, they were beginning to pick up large numbers of sympathies and voters and all the rest. So the people at the top understood, how about a better system? We have two parties, and we make the whole political system be a contest between the two, but we make both of them dependent on us, so that neither of them can afford to alienate us, to upset us, to pursue laws or rules or regulations that limit or constrain us. We'll make them both us, and therefore we can throw out one when people get antsy and bring in the other one. And then when nothing really changes and they get angry at the one we brought in, we say, okay, we'll give you the other party. And we go back and forth in exactly the way that the Republicans and Democrats have been doing for years in this country. And I think that's what you see. You get the Democratic Party is dependent on huge donors that are of one frame of mind, and the Republican Party is on the other. So that the one thing that the candidates on both sides have in common is they never have a critical word to say about capitalism. If you think about it, it's actually extraordinary. They will talk about a problem over here or there in housing or in tariffs or in price gouging or whatever else they might occasionally talk about. But when they do, it's never the capitalist system that is part of the problem, let alone the key part of the problem. And so they come up with little piecemeal reforms and suggestions, which either pass or don't, and in any case do not solve the problem. I mean, let me give you just one stark example. The minimum wage in this country, the federal minimum wage, is $7.25 an hour. That was last raised to that lofty level in the year 2009. That's 15 years ago. During every one of the 15 years since then, prices have gone up in the United States for milk and eggs and coffee and gasoline and everything else. But what we pay the poorest of the poor workers in America remained the same, $7.25, so they could, of course, afford less and less with each passing year. Republican presidents did that. Democratic presidents did it. Republican Congresses did it. Democratic Congresses did it. Somehow, with all the differences we're supposed to believe exist between them, when it came to something that a lot of capitalists want, namely cheap labor, suddenly magic, they couldn't find a disagreement about it. It's really extraordinary when you watch it. We have no opposition to capitalism that's allowed to play any kind of role. We have a duopoly, a system of politics that makes it impossible for third parties to get off the ground. And that's carefully done to make sure that this theater, in which you have a debate, in which you can say with a straight face that you're worried about immigrants eating pets, but you cannot discuss capitalism. That is weird in a world in which capitalism is everywhere understood to be a system in a lot of problem and a lot of crisis right now.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner. The two of us are co-hosting Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with the economist Richard Wolff, who's just written a book called Understanding Capitalism, a wonderful book. Rick, the countervailing forces that could potentially fight fascism in this country are fairly weak, but they exist. There's an upsurge in the union movement. The Palestine solidarity efforts are remarkable. We had the Black Lives Matter movement and the Occupy movement. This brought about the popular notion of the 1% as opposed to the rest of us, the 99%. And lately we had the Bernie Sanders phenomena. Socialism is no longer a dirty word in America. How do you appreciate all of this?
More and more of these young people, and particularly the young, but the older ones too, they are really demanding change. The old socialist dream, which always was expressible in this phrase, we can do better than capitalism. That instinct is what took people who lived in slavery and finally allowed them to say, we've had it with this system, it has to go. And it did. And the same thing happened with the serfs in feudalism. This has to go. And it did. And we shouldn't be all that surprised that sooner or later, after perhaps a dozen false starts, a mass movement will say, we can do better than capitalism. We don't have to divide ourselves into 3% of the people who are employers and 97% who are employees, so that the employers enrich themselves, keep the power for themselves. And we're all wondering, well, how secure our job is, whether we can give an education to our children. This is not a necessary way, any more than slavery was necessary or serfdom was necessary. And I think you're seeing that. And I think those movements that you mentioned are precisely the signs in various communities that sooner or later, this system's contradictions will blow it up. The labor movement isn't new. You know, it's 100 years old, 200 years old in this country, and older in Europe. They've been fighting the employer for a long time. They've had a longer history, and they've done better, by the way, than American workers have. I want to remind everyone that we here in this country don't have what working class struggles, usually led by socialists, were able to achieve, for example, in Western Europe. I'm still amazed as a professor, lived, born and raised in America and taught in American universities all my life, when I explain that in France, for example, when you graduate high school and you take a job, the law requires the employer to give you 5 weeks of paid vacation from day one. Doesn't depend on who your union is or isn't. Doesn't depend on who your employer is. It's the law. Socialists got that law. Higher education in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, is effectively free. No tuition, no fees. Why? Because the socialist movement fought for those things. Americans can't even imagine it. And that's partly because the socialism has been kept at bay by defining politics as if it went no further than what you saw last night.
And certainly you've made the point that both of the political parties that dominate the scene in this country, the Republicans and Democrats, they're both capitalist parties. And both of the candidates for president, whether it be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, are also have that philosophy, that political economic philosophy. But in the context of the growing fear of fascism in this country, do you not think there is a qualitative political difference there between, well, between Trump and Harris? I know a good many people on the left do. They argue there is a great deal of a difference. They say, well, you know, Trump, along with the fascistic nationalism of that Project 2025 report that you referenced, would represent, if he were elected, a further big, dangerous step towards fascism in America, or at the very least, the coming of an authoritarian president if Trump is elected. So what are your thoughts on that, given that, nevertheless, both candidates are themselves capitalists from capitalist parties?
Well, my sense is the following. Sometimes the little difference is the only difference you can grab hold of, and I think we're in that situation. Mr. Trump seems to be very comfortable imagining a fascistic turn in the United States, especially one with him at the helm. He idolizes leaders around the world who have also taken steps in that direction. He clearly is a Republican. He clearly favors capital over labor. He doesn't understand most of the issues that are involved there other than from an employer point of view. So, yeah, I think he would be the easiest, quickest convert to a fascistic solution as the problems arise for which this capitalism in America is so poorly prepared to deal. I think the difference is that Kamala Harris would take a little longer. She might be a bit more hesitant to make those moves. If you're asking me, is she capable of ending up in a similar place? I don't have the slightest doubt that she is. She has been part of this system all of her life, certainly all of her adult life, and there's no reason to doubt that she would. But I think that the real question is, and that has always been the case, will the mass of the people allow either of them, and I mean either of them, to go in that direction? The union movement isn't going to do that. Black Lives Matter isn't going to do that. The Palestinian people concerned about the horror there, are those movements going to grow? Are those movements going to converge and become a power together? Let me give an example right now, because people wonder, oh, that's a pie in the sky. The last national election in France, which was literally a few weeks ago, saw a remarkable development in a country not that different from the United States. Four different left-wing political parties. The French Socialist Party, the French Communist Party, the French Green Party, and the largest of them, a party known as France Unbowed, led by a Marxist, former communist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They ran for office. They're now the number one political party in France. They have the largest number of seats. Mr. Macron, who's we hear is the leader of France, came in third out of three major parties. He's finished politically, and the left, when it unified, is now in a dominant, powerful position in the French government. And this is not pie in the sky and not fanciful notion. If the left in the United States can overcome its narrowness, its division into too many little groups, and it can become focused, it will be the determinant of whether any fascism takes root again in the United States, or whether instead capitalism will have to find an alternative way to solve its problems rather than to degenerate into a fascism the way it did when it couldn't solve its problems in Italy or France or Spain or Japan in the last century that we saw with such devastating effects. That's the issue. That's why what happens on the left in the United States is a crucial. And the understanding that capitalism is the problem is why, not only why I wrote the book, but why I thought it could contribute to an overcoming of what's holding back the best bet we have to prevent fascism.
Richard Wolff, it's been terrific having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to go, can you tell people how can they get your book, Understanding Capitalism, and how can people keep up with your work?
Well, the answer to both questions is the same, and it's very simple. Just go to our website, and it's called democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracy at work, no punctuation, democracyatwork.info. There you will find out about the new book, Understanding Capitalism, and everything else we do to make these arguments and to disseminate them globally.
Well, my goodness. Richard Wolff, again, we thank you so much. It's always the pleasure to have you here on Law and Disorder. Thank you for being with us again and for so clearly and passionately explaining what is at stake.
Okay, and my hat's off to both of you and all of you for maintaining this program. It's one of the ways to get these issues put on the table, which is more necessary now than ever before.
Richard Wolff, a million thanks for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Instead of the socialist ideal of universal human emancipation that many European Jews supported, Zionist Israel is the outcome of an ideology that a relatively small number of middle and upper-class European Jews advanced unsuccessfully until after the Holocaust of World War II. Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, an Austrian-Hungarian journalist, was a great admirer of Cecil Rhodes, the British imperial figure who founded the mineral-rich settler colony of Rhodesia in southern Africa. From its inception, the goal of Zionism was to overwhelm and displace the native Arabs in Palestine. Despite its own self-promotion, Israel's not the moral legatee of the victims of the Holocaust, much less of the prophets of the Hebrew people who propounded the Ten Commandments, especially the third, "Thou shalt not kill." The horrific slaughter since last October 7th of the Palestinians in Gaza has been live-streamed for people all over the world to see. As we approach the one-year anniversary of this ongoing genocide, we speak with scholar Amaya Gelman. She was a professor at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, but like many of her colleagues, her contract was not renewed. Amaya Gelman is the founder of the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. Her book on the powerful Zionist organization, the Anti-Defamation League, will be published by the University of California Press. Amaya Gelman, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amaya, what is Zionism, and why do you think Zionism is an area for academic study?
I think the question of what is Zionism is really important because it has many different meanings and it's used in different ways. But what Zionism is now today is a political movement and set of ideas that are attached to a powerful state and to a military. And they are the rationale for the ongoing genocide against Palestinians that we're seeing. They're the rationale for the establishment of a state on top of land that already belonged to people and was not sort of available for claiming. And it's the rationale for U.S. support and the support of other well-resourced and militarized states for an ongoing colonial project. So some people might say, well, Zionism is a yearning of Jewish people to be in, you know, Jerusalem or the homeland. That's an old definition, and it's certainly true that Judaism contains that yearning, but that's not what Zionism is in its practice. In its practice, it's a politics, it's armed, and it is currently imposing a genocide. And not only a genocide in Palestine, it's also imposing massive political repression around the world by the supporters of Zionism, who often are part of the state apparatus, part of corporate and capital apparatus, certainly part of defense industries. It's part of a project to make the land and the resources of the Middle East, of Palestine, available to, I think we could easily describe as Western interests, who are interested not only in those resources, but also in removing the people, the cultures, and the ways of Palestinians.
Certainly we can understand why it's an issue of requiring study today and why it's in the news today and so forth. But I wonder, has there nevertheless been a study of Zionism preceding this time of high controversy? How long, and if so, how long has it been a field of study, if you will?
People have been studying Zionism since its inception, since its origins in the late 1800s. And I'm talking about political Zionism again here. Palestinian scholars especially have been observing it and analyzing and critiquing it. I'm actually part of a kind of exciting new work group that's looking at the archive of Fayez Zayed, who's the political philosopher and activist who created the Arab Information Center in the 50s in the U.S. He's just an example of folks who have been analyzing and historicizing Zionism since its inception. There's also plenty of research on Zionism beyond that, in the fields of colonial studies, in Jewish studies also, in disability studies and environmental studies. Basically, Zionism is a power structure and a history and a politics. So you can look at any subject to see how Zionism relates to it. The idea of studying it, though, has been kind of made problematic or, you know, subjected people to attack because there has been a huge investment by Zionist donors and by the Israeli state as well in trying to create centers of study in U.S. and other Western universities that look at Zionism only as a sort of aspiration of Jewish people and culture. So it's really hard, actually, to look critically at Zionism as a power structure because you're immediately subject to attack by these sort of powerful academic structures that say, you know, unless you are studying it, you know, with a sort of eye to defending it, that you're being anti-Semitic. So it's important to say that it's a field of study that's not attached to the state of Israel. It's not attached to the study of the Jewish people. As Edward Said said, it's, you know, one must study Zionism from the standpoint of its victims, just as we study any power structure from below.
Amaya, is there a pushback against people like you who understand that it's a power structure we're talking about? I know that you've recently had your contract not renewed at Sarah Lawrence. Could you please talk to us a bit about this?
This is a moment of massive repression across the entire United States and also across parts of Europe. We see that, for example, in Germany, it's really sort of jumped the shark, as they say, that simply speaking about Zionism as a colonial project, which its founders identified it as, right? Simply talking about history and looking factually at Zionism can get you arrested, it can get you fired, can certainly subject you to violence by Zionist mobs, as we saw at the University of California, UCLA, students who were encamped to in solidarity with Palestine and to call for the University of California to divest from the weapons manufacturers that are providing the hardware for this genocide, were met with literally armed mobs, like jointly organized between Zionist opponents of the movement to stop genocide and MAGA white nationalists, literally attacking people. And that included faculty, that included students. And the sort of motivation for their attack is not just, well, people are protesting, it's they are trying to silence these discussions about genocide and colonialism and the centrality of state violence and racism to Zionism. So a lot of faculty have been fired because of the fact that so many faculty are already not tenured, that, you know, they're precarious, they're on year-to-year contracts. A lot of that is not even visible because all that has to happen is that somebody's contract doesn't get renewed. So my contract didn't get renewed. I was an active and visible member of Faculty for Justice in Palestine at Sarah Lawrence. My work is studying and critiquing the Anti-Defamation League. And also Sarah Lawrence, like many colleges in the United States, had been the subject of a Title VI civil rights complaint that was filed by Hillel, the Jewish/Zionist campus organization that's closely tied to the Anti-Defamation League and also works with the conservative Brandeis Center for Human Rights under law, which has been bringing similar complaints against colleges. So Sarah Lawrence, the complaint is about anti-Semitism, alleging anti-Semitism at Sarah Lawrence. The truth is that at Sarah Lawrence, like so many other colleges and universities around the United States, at least, the campus was overwhelmingly supportive of Palestinian civil rights, human rights, and overwhelmingly opposed genocide. And a lot of that work was led by Jewish students. So the idea that it was anti-Semitic was sort of a fabrication that brings legal pressure to bear on the university or the college. It doesn't matter if it's true, right? Because the thing that matters is the risk that you're going to be dragged into court. So those are the conditions at Sarah Lawrence. My contract wasn't renewed. They did re-advertise the job. It's hard to say exactly what happened, but the situation is that across the United States, people are being fired for teaching and talking about Palestine. Yes.
I wonder, Amaya, How widespread now do you think? Certainly what has gone on and is continuing to go on in the horrific situation in Gaza and the demonstrations that you've alluded to and the writings and speeches about it. Certainly more people are familiar with the term, I suspect, than in the past in terms of the general public, certainly. How is it properly defined? Is it possible to give a clear and understandable definition of what the term actually means? Oh, I realize it may have meant something different 100 years ago than it means today, or not, I don't know. But how today would one honestly and realistically define the term Zionism?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, like how much do people know, it's really been a war of information. So on the one hand, we have Palestinians live streaming their own genocide on social media and coming directly to U.S. audiences in a way that really bypasses the kind of blackout on discussion of Israeli violence that mainstream media organizations have imposed for a really long time. So people have more information and more access to information than they've ever had. And it's so blatant, right? Like, we see videos of Israeli soldiers committing war crimes. So bombing and shooting buildings and shooting at people for no identifiable reason, doing things like triumphantly writing Stars of David on the walls of homes that they have taken over, using people as human shields. Like, we don't need to tell anybody anymore that these are the acts that the Israeli military and Israeli society are carrying out and celebrating. I mean, we also see Israelis sort of en masse coming in to back these actions. So the question is, do people understand that as Zionism? And what we're seeing is that Zionist organizations in the U.S. that have an enormous platform because they have claimed for so long to represent Jewish communities. They haven't said they were Zionist. They said they were Jewish, like the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, Hillel, that those organizations are using their platforms in mainstream media, their relationships with universities, for example, to simply say, like, no, that's not Zionism. What you're seeing is, you're not seeing it. And in fact, Zionism is a dream, or Zionism is a wish, or a farm, right? That we made a farm that on land in Palestine. That's Zionism. So the question that we have, that we're left with, is, can people distinguish between the framing that these organizations are trying to impose and the reality that they're seeing? I don't think there's any way for people to claim at this point that they don't know what's going on. The question is, what story are they telling themselves about it? But I will say one other thing, which is, we have in recent memory the experience of a broad-based social media anti-racist movement, Black Lives Matter. So it was a protest movement, very physical, very tangible, in the streets, a mass movement involving so many people, like the biggest mass movement in the United States, probably ever. And it taught people ideas. We didn't hear about settler colonialism as a, in everyday conversation, the way that we do since Black Lives Matter taught us that we have to talk about it in the context of race and policing. It may be that people understood that maybe more tangibly in the last round of student movements in the late 60s, early 70s, but it was certainly not part of popular culture in the present until it was popularized through mass movement. And I think the same thing is happening right now with anti-Zionism and the movement against genocide, is that the language that people need in order to understand and oppose this is becoming popularized because we're sharing it with each other.
I'm sorry, very, very helpful. I just wonder then, and maybe the answer to my question is it can't be answered exactly, but is it possible now, if somebody were to say to you, well, in 25 words or less, can you give us an honest intellectual definition of what Zionism is?
Sure. I'm actually going to lean on some language that's coming out of a broad coalition to end Zionist repression, which has tried to articulate this. So Zionism is an ideology of Jewish ethno-nationalism, a settler colonial ideology driving the establishment of Israel through the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, using genocidal violence, seeking to displace, disable, and disappear Palestinian people and their heritage. It's not inherently religious. It's not inherently Jewish. It's a project of militarized colonization.
Zionists are trying to suppress any discussion of Zionism. They say that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. Could you talk about this, please?
The move to classify criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic has a history that I think it's important to know about. So we're seeing it in spades right now, right? We're seeing it not only coming from Zionist Jewish organizations and Christian Zionist organizations, which, by the way, Christian Zionist organizations are much bigger and much more, much stronger even than Jewish Zionist organizations. And we're seeing it come from the right wing of U.S. politics, which doesn't particularly care about Israel one way or another, but is just leveraging it. We're seeing this discussion of like this sort of push, an anti-Semitism panic, which actually the media studies scholar A.J. Bauer has helpfully called a Palestine panic, a Palestine scare, rather, in the same vein as the Red Scare. This history begins in the mid-70s when the veneer of liberation movement has started to fall away from the Israeli state after the 1967 war, after 1972 invasions. The notion that Israel is like an underdog and a liberatory, like, you know, a sort of Jewish anti-racist project falls away. And people begin to critique the idea of Israel, including the massive student-led anti-racist and anti-war movement at the time. In 1974, in direct response to this, the Anti-Defamation League published a book called The New Anti-Semitism, which alleged that now that U.S. Jews had sort of made it and were included in politics and included in, you know, in corporate life and economically stable, their interests and their interest in Israel were part of the interest of the establishment. And the establishment is the word that they used in the book. And therefore, opposing the establishment, which is, of course, what the left was doing, was anti-Jewish. That's the equation. They made the equation, Jews are the state, and so opposing the state is anti-Semitic. And also, because the U.S. and Israel are part of the same kind of, you know, state apparatus, opposing Israel is anti-Semitic. And we have never stopped hearing the term the new anti-Semitism since then. It's always, you know, there's new anti-Semitism. It's spiking. If anti-Semitism had spiked every year that the ADL said that anti-Semitism had spiked, it would be a miracle that, you know, that we were standing here, that we as U.S. Jews were able to, you know, even have this conversation. So that's the history of it. So what we're seeing now is just like coming to fruition and, you know, hyping up, but it's not new. It's just a tool for repression.
You remind me by that answer in terms of what the anti-war movement of this country went through, for example, during Vietnam, when criticism of what the U.S. was doing in some people's mind was criticism of the American people, not being able to see the distinction between the two. But going back again to this business of Zionism, President Biden has boasted that he's an Irish-American Zionist. I don't know quite what that means, but and Biden is, of course, a Catholic. There are also a good many, fundamentalist Christians who claim to be, or at least support Zionism. In the case of the fundamentalist Christians who believe or support Zionism, what is that about, do you think? What do they actually believe?
So Christian Zionists are of more than one, there's more than one strand of Christian Zionism, but the basic idea is that biblical prophecy must be fulfilled by regathering Jews in the land of Israel, at which point, you know, Jews will all be destroyed and the kingdom of Christ will be restored on earth. That's the Jews version of Christian Zionism. Sorry, I don't have more specifics, but it is a deeply Islamophobic, a deeply racist version of Christianity that views, and also anti-Semitic, obviously, that views everybody except Christians as expendable, which is, you know, that idea is not probably foreign to people who have encountered fundamentalist Christianity. The idea is like, if you're not on board with Christianity, then basically you're lost, right? So we're not going to save you. So Christian Zionism is about creating the conditions for Armageddon, basically. It's not a supportive movement of Jews, although it has absolutely learned to use the language of opposing anti-Semitism as a way to legitimate what it's doing.
So, Amaya, I want you to talk a bit about your work around the Anti-Defamation League. Indeed, the book that you are working on is about that. So let our listeners know, what is the Anti-Defamation League? What's its function? How does it go about achieving that goal or that function or that purpose?
The Anti-Defamation League is mostly known to people in the U.S. as a civil rights advocate and an education organization that intervenes if your school has a racist incident, right? People often turn to the ADL to come in and do kind of training or programming. That is a very pinhole view of what the ADL does, and the politics of the ADL never really get considered as people are thinking about its work on civil rights. So the short version is that the ADL is fundamentally an organization that is invested in law and order in the United States and in the globe. It's a settler organization. Its view of what is good and moral is a Eurocentric liberal version. So for example, it may be interested in equality under law, but it is not interested in challenging capitalism. In fact, it views those who challenge capitalism as enemies of the state. And so it's really completely at odds with anti-racist movements and social justice movements. Beyond that, even though it didn't start this way in 1913 when it was founded, it became a Zionist organization. It became a Zionist organization in at least the 50s, maybe a little bit before, but it's the reason that it became a Zionist organization was because it, not because it was interested in the project of Jewish liberation or, you know, socialism or whatever, but because it understood Israel as a potential outpost of Western civilization in the Middle East. So civilization against barbarism, right? That's Herzl's explanation of what Zionism is going to be and what Zionism is going to do in Palestine. And the ADL is all about that. Its view is that to the extent that it supports, Western liberalism, it is also supporting the imposition of those same politics on other places and people throughout the world. It is actually a neoconservative organization. So it's maybe that's a little confusing because liberalism and neoconservatism are actually pretty close in nature. So we're used to thinking in the US of liberals as one side of the aisle and conservatives as the other. But they're actually in many ways closely united. The work that I'm doing in the book is on the ADL's history, because we really understand the ADL largely in terms of through its own narration of whatever it's doing in the present. So it might say we're doing anti-racism trainings in schools. Those anti-racism trainings turn out to be Zionist and anti-Palestinian and repressive of anybody who disagrees with them. But regardless, because they're called anti-racism trainings, people think of the ADL in those terms. But if you understand the ADL historically, it was not understood at all as a progressive organization for much of its existence. It was anti-communist in nature. That's how it sort of rose to prominence, by working with the U.S. state to do anti-communist work after World War II. Its origins even before that are in the elite upper class segment of U.S. Jewry that looked at Jewish immigrants and thought, no way are these people going to be able to represent us. We have to quash their poor alterity. We have to make them less left. We have to make sure they don't threaten the genteel nature of Jewishness in the U.S. state. So fundamentally, the ADL works as an organization that tries to discipline and tamp down any kind of dissent. The versions of that, the iterations of that that we see across different periods of history might look a little different, but it's pretty consistent in those values. And at the moment, what the ADL is doing is using its reputation as a civil rights organization to try and be an advisor to campuses and to schools and to institutions on how to handle what this what they're calling a crisis of anti-Semitism, which is also a crisis that has been manufactured through statistics that the ADL produces itself. So it's a bit of a closed loop. And challenging it has been a project that really has been left to organizations, anti-racist organizations in the grassroots, which are often led by people of color, often led by Palestinian and Arab people who are the most vulnerable to the ADL's attacks. But that effort has kind of crystallized under the banner of Drop the ADL, which you can read more about at droptheadl.org. And I will actually just tease. I'll tease that there is a new effort underway that has been put together by educators who are so horrified at how the ADL has been called upon to intervene since October 7th and how racist and damaging their interventions are in school. And that effort is focusing on the ADL's, on getting the ADL out of K-12 schools. It's called Drop the ADL from Schools.org. So I invite your listeners to go check that out. It's actually really exciting.
We've been speaking with Amaya Gelman, who is the founder of the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. Unfortunately, Amaya, we've come to an end to our allotted time, but we have one more question we'd like to pose to you. What do you see as the future of Zionism and anti-Zionism, both in the long run and in the short run?
That is a huge and important question. I think that when political movement is built on repression and fictions and trying to get people to not see something, it can't hold, right? That Zionism can't hold. The question of how does it fall apart? I mean, it seems to be undoing itself right now in terms of the genocide and just complete dissolution of the pretense of being any kind of democratic or liberatory movement. Anti-Zionism is also really finding its feet right now. I think people are having important and difficult conversations to try and define it to each other and try to figure out how to operationalize it, thinking about how do you not only push back on the Israeli state and Zionist institutions in the U.S., but also on the ways that Zionism has become a kind of political lever, even for other, like, not particularly Zionist repressive forces. I think people are doing really incredible organizing and thinking about that. And I am excited to be part of it and hopeful, really hopeful.
And the website to follow your work, how can our listeners keep in touch with your work?
The Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism is at criticalzionismstudies.org. We have tons of research and resources and opportunities to participate, and I hope people will come find us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Amaya, this has been a brilliant conversation. Jim and I are so grateful for your being a guest on Law and Disorder. We'd like to have you back on when your book comes out. You take it easy.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.